All right, please be seated. Welcome. The next case on our argument calendar today is Ronald Dixon et al. Versus the City of North Las Vegas. Mr. Levine, you ready to go on that case, sir?
I am. May it please the Court again, Adam Levine and Danny Marks. This time we just switch tables rather than switch the placards. On behalf of Ronald Dixon and 20 former employees of the City of North Las Vegas, I would like to start, and I requested from the clerk to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would like to start with an observation made 48 years ago by the United States Supreme Court in connection with the issue of the individual employee's right to pursue a breach of a collective bargaining agreement. We cannot believe that Congress, in conferring upon employers and unions the power to establish exclusive grievance procedures, intended to confer upon unions such unlimited discretion to deprive injured employees of all remedies for breach of contract, nor do we think that Congress intended to shield employers from the natural consequences of their breaches of bargaining agreements by wrongful union conduct in the enforcement of such agreements. Likewise, when the Nevada legislature adopted Chapter 288, giving local government employees the same bargaining rights as conferred by Congress under the National Labor Relations Act, the Nevada legislature likewise did not intend to confer such unlimited discretion upon unions or deprive employees of a remedy. Therefore, the issue now before this Court to be decided is when such a circumstance occurs, where it is alleged that a bargaining agreement is breached and a union has not advanced a grievance on behalf of the employee, in which forum is that breach of contract case to be heard? And if it is in the district court, as we assert that it is, what is the appropriate standard to be applied? The federal standard under Baca versus Sipes, which requires evidence of a breach of the duty of fair representation by a union, or the approach taken by courts in such as Alaska in the Casey versus City of Fairbanks case, or the Anderson case out of California, which does not require actual proof of a breach of the duty of fair representation, but merely a showing that the employee attempted to exhaust the contractual remedies and was prevented from doing so.
Mr. Marks, let me ask you just a basic threshold question. Does our EMRB have exclusive jurisdiction?
The EMRB says it does not, and that is why this action was filed in the district court. The EMRB has filed an amicus brief, which I believe is correct, which is that an administrative agency only has such jurisdiction as conferred by the legislature. Neither the agency nor this court may enlarge that jurisdiction, and the legislature has not given the EMRB jurisdiction over breach of contract claims. Now, this is a very important point. Our EMRB, and the way the legislature has set up our EMRB, is modeled on the federal National Labor Relations Board, which likewise does not have jurisdiction over breach of contract cases. Other states have, by statute, defined a prohibited labor practice as a willful breach of a collective bargaining agreement. Our prohibited practices are set out under NRS 288-270. It does not include the breach of a bargaining agreement under the definition of prohibited practices. I'll give you a good example, and this is the example in the case cited by the city when they convinced the district court. Look at the Hawaii. Hawaii says that Hawaii's PERB, Public Employee Relations Board, the Hawaii equivalent of our EMRB, they hear it. Well, that's because Hawaii has a statute that defines as a prohibited practice the willful breach of a bargaining agreement. And I gave the court in our opening brief, and I believe the reply brief, examples from other states, such as Oregon, and citations to other statutes. We have no such statute in Nevada that would authorize the EMRB to hear a case on breach of contract, and consequently, the EMRB has repeatedly refused to do so. Now, I think the court also needs to recognize that the EMRB is not a full-time adjudicated body. It is by statute funded by contributions by local government employers based on the number of employees that they have. As a practical matter, the EMRB would collapse under the caseload if all of a sudden it was to hear breach of contract cases. Now, the big issue to be determined is what is the appropriate standard in the district court, and we believe it does belong in the district court. What happened in this case was a motion to dismiss was filed and originally denied by the district court, where the district court said, I'm going to follow the federal VACA standard, and the district court set an evidentiary hearing on the issue of whether there's evidence of a breach of the duty of fair representation by Teamsters Local 14, who was the exclusive bargaining agent. Both myself and the city filed motions for reconsideration. The position I took was I am prepared to go forward under the VACA standard. However, the better approach is the approach taken by states such as California or Alaska, which doesn't require this because, as Alaska pointed out in the Casey decision, I believe very persuasively, public employment is different. Unlike employment in the private sector under the VACA standard, there is no due process interest implicated. A public employee who is post-probationary, of course, has a property interest in their employment. That is well-established law. If you take away the ability to have a hearing in district court where the union won't advance the grievance, they are potentially deprived of their property interest in their employment without so much as a hearing, and that raises severe constitutional concerns.
Under those circumstances, is the determination of the union's breach of fair representation a gateway determination to a district court action? And if so, is that a determination that must first be made by the EMRB before the district court action can proceed?
Under the federal VACA standard, the answer is no. The United States Supreme Court, in subsequent cases such as Del Costello, has said you don't have to go to the National Labor Relations Board. Remember, the National Labor Relations Board has jurisdiction over claims against unions for breach of the duty of fair representation. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said you can sue in district court under Section 301 without going to the NLRB or without even naming the union. It is up to the plaintiff to make that determination. Likewise, California does not require you to go before their PERB before you go into district court. And to require the EMRB to hear such a case before it went into district court would be a extremely poor use of either judicial or quasi-judicial resources, because the underlying facts of the case are going to have to be presented to the EMRB. You're essentially asking somebody to try a case twice. There's no need to try a case in front of the EMRB, put on all the evidence, only to go around and then try it against a different entity in district court. That is not a good use of, again, judicial or quasi-judicial in the case of EMRB resources.
Well, but the determination of a breach of contract claim by the EMRB seems to be an open question, but the decision about whether a union has breached its duty of fair representation seems to be explicitly covered under the EMRB statutory scheme.
Absolutely. In fact, this court previously...
Aren't we at risk of having competing outcomes, one where the EMRB says, no, the union didn't breach, but a district court determines otherwise?
Well, if the court were to adopt the Casey and Anderson approach, which is what I am advocating, that is not a concern. All you have to do is, you don't have to prove a breach of the duty of fair representation. You need simply demonstrate to the court, we attempted to exhaust the grievance provisions under the contract and were prevented from doing so. It doesn't require an express finding of the breach of the duty of fair representation. As the Casey court pointed out, that it is possible in some cases that a union won't take a case forward to arbitration erroneously, but doesn't rise to the level of arbitrary, capricious, or in bad faith, and depriving the employee of then any remedy under such circumstances, quote, places too great a burden upon the right to due process.
Under your approach, can the union prosecute an arbitration dispute or grievance on the same issues and set of facts while the employee is prosecuting a separate independent cause of action against the employer?
No, that would never occur because, as Vaca pointed out, as Republic Steel Corp. versus Maddox in 1965 pointed out, before you can go to court to vindicate, you must demonstrate that your contractual remedies have been exhausted. In other words, if the union is pursuing the action, there is no basis to go to district court because the contractual remedies have not been exhausted yet. You have to demonstrate an exhaustion under even the Casey and Anderson approach before you can go to court. You simply don't have to show that it was arbitrary, capricious, or in bad faith.
So if you must do that, if the employee is impeded by that approach, why wouldn't the employee demonstrate that the union was arbitrary or breached their duty of fair representation as a condition precedent to prosecuting the claim?
Because
even as an element in the district court action.
Because as Casey pointed out, it may be negligence on the part of the union as opposed to arbitrary and capricious or in bad faith. The union may have dropped the ball negligently, but then foreclosing an employee's ability to get a post-termination hearing of any sort, which is what an arbitration would be, again, places too great a burden on the due process rights. I believe I'm into my rebuttal time.
Before you sit down, from your standpoint, do we need to do anything with the Supreme Court's 2002 holding in Rosequist?
I believe Rosequist supports our position because, and this is a very key point that I argued to the district court, in Rosequist, there were two claims, breach of contract, breach of the duty of fair representation. The district court granted summary judgment on the contract claims and dismissed the duty of fair representation claim for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Implicit in that decision was that the court has jurisdiction on the contract claim because summary judgment is a judgment on the merits. There is no genuine issue of fact and requires a court to have jurisdiction. If the court didn't have jurisdiction on the contract claim, both would have been dismissed as opposed to summary judgment being granted on the contract claim and the duty of fair representation claim being dismissed under 12b1 subject matter jurisdiction.
Is your analysis in this case affected at all by this court's decision in City of Reno?
I don't believe so. This is the recent City of Reno case that just came down within the last month. I read it, and I don't believe I saw anything in there that addresses, that was the layoff case where the layoff was expressly reserved, reserved under the contract. No, this is simply a case of who hears the contract claim. Absent a statute giving the EMRB jurisdiction, this court and the EMRB are not at liberty to enlarge the jurisdiction of an administrative agency. That is set by the legislature.
Okay, Mr. Levine, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sandra Douglas Morgan. I'm the city attorney for the city of North Las Vegas, and with me is Claudia Aguayo, a senior deputy city attorney, and we represent the respondent this morning. The appellants here are asking this court to legislate a third remedy in addition to the already existing grievance procedure listed in the contract between the City of North Las Vegas and Teamsters Local 14, and in addition to their rights right now to file an unfair labor practice charge before the Nevada Employee Management Relations Board. Ms. Aguayo will be addressing the issues involving standing and the failure of the appellants to exhaust their administrative remedies, but I just wanted to give the court a little bit of background regarding the City of North Las Vegas and the fact that we recently faced well-publicized, unprecedented financial challenges since 2008. Our workforce has decreased from 2,000 employees to 1,000 employees in the last 5 years, and we exerted its management right to lay off employees when we had to close our detention center in 2012. This management right was affirmed by this court in the City of Reno versus IAF matter that you resolved in December of 2013, that local governments have the right to lay off employees when there is a basic lack of funds. The City of North Las Vegas and Teamsters Local 14 are parties to three collective bargaining agreements, and these appellants have chosen Teamsters Local 14 to be their exclusive bargaining agent. That bargaining agent exclusivity is listed in the collective bargaining agreement. It's also listed in NRS 288. They have chosen to designate Teamsters Local 14 and their exclusive remedy for any issue involving the interpretation or the application of their collective bargaining agreement is the grievance procedure. Allowing appellants to file individual breach of contract actions in district court solely against the city as the defendant would create a tremendous burden on all local governments, employers who are trying to provide the most basic public safety and municipal services to its residents. This would create a necessity for all local governments to expend additional time, money, and resources to litigate an unquantifiable amount of claims and grievances with individual union members. This undermines the entire collective bargaining process. It's in direct contravention with the public policy regarding collective bargaining, and it would render the contractually agreed upon and statutory bargaining agent useless. Despite this, the appellants still decided to go forward and file a breach of contract action in district court without filing anything against their union before the NRB or in district court. And Ms. Aguayo, I would like to invite her up now to further address why the appellants do not have standing to bring this claim, and that even if you do find they had standing, they failed to exhaust their administrative remedies. The standing issue has already been addressed by this court in Ruiz, and Ms. Aguayo can.
As the city attorney stated, the contract here expressly states that the only two parties to that contract are the union and the city. The contract also states that the exclusive remedy for any disputes arising out of that agreement is the grievance procedure contained therein. Those provisions are in the joint appendix at 124, 176.
Counsel, isn't there some case law about third-party beneficiaries of intended parties and their rights?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to point out that the appellants in this case did not make the third-party beneficiary argument below in the district court. They first brought it up on appeal. So that argument is waived. However, to the extent this court wishes to entertain that argument, the Ruiz case is instructive on that issue. In Ruiz, not only did this court reject the individual employee's attempt to enforce the terms of his collective bargaining agreement independent of his union, but they also rejected his attempt for that union to assign its rights to that independent employee. And the reasoning behind this court, the court used in Ruiz, applies here, and it's what the city attorney touched on. It would entirely frustrate the purposes of collective bargaining. It would render the sole bargaining agent useless if the individual would be forced to litigate claims individually with hundreds, if not thousands, of individual employees. So in that respect, they essentially rejected the third-party beneficiary argument.
Do you have a response to the EMRB argument that was made in terms of exclusive jurisdiction or not having exclusive jurisdiction?
Yes, absolutely. The cases cited by the EMRB are distinguishable from the case at bar. The EMRB cited cases not necessarily involving breach of the duty of fair representation. Our position is that Rosequist is directly on point. And this court has essentially already answered the questions of this complaint in Rosequist. Now, evaluation of a complaint happens on a case-by-case basis. Each complaint has different allegations, and each complaint is evaluated on a case-by-case basis. In Rosequist, the complaint, as Mr. Levine stated, involved breach of contract claims against the union, as well as breach of the duty of fair representation claims against the union. If you substitute the public employer for the union in Rosequist, you have this case. There, this court said that they failed to exhaust administrative remedies by bringing the entire complaint to the EMRB, not just the duty of fair representation claim there. And it was basically, essentially, the same type of allegations here. The facts are different. In this case involves more collective bargaining issues than the Rosequist case, which is a just cause for termination case. This case involves layoffs, which, as we learned in the city of Reno, is an exclusive management right, not arbitrable. So the question of arbitrability is raised. That is the issue that is addressed in 288.150 under management rights. So if the question, if the reasoning in Rosequist is applied here, and the reasoning was, is there a covered entity under 288, which we have here, we have a public employer under 288 and a union under 288 and a public employee under 288. So everybody's covered by 288. The next question in Rosequist that this court asked was whether or not the action arises out of interpretation or application of the provisions of 288. In this case, I mean, I don't want to to inundate the court with a bunch of statutes, but we have 288.110 at issue. We have 288.140, which talks about standing, whether or not an individual employee who is represented can invoke 288.140 as Ruiz attempted to do to bring individual claims.
Does it change your observation if this case is narrowed to the issue of failure to pay the accrued annual leave for the party's discharge?
That's another issue that arises out of 288. Failure to pay annual leave is an issue that arises under 288.150 as a subject of mandatory bargaining. That is a unilateral alteration of on a subject of mandatory bargaining is an unfair labor practice.
That particular distinction in terms of labor practice, but when they're saying their union didn't properly represent them in order to come in,
right,
is that an exception? Or in this case,
there doesn't need to be, an exception does not need to be carved in this case. We have the statutes that directly address these issues. We have Rosequist, which directly addresses these issues. These issues are issues arising out of the terms and conditions of 288.
It's interesting that both of you are saying that Rosequist supports your positions. Has read it differently.
Well, stated another way, are you suggesting that the employee's remedy for unpaid compensation is through their a complaint with the EMRB over unfair representation by their union?
Yes, well, they have 2 to 3 potential remedies in this case. They obviously have the grievance procedure contained in the agreement, which is the exclusive remedy.
And which their union didn't pursue.
In this case, the union chose not to pursue. That's correct.
Right.
However, their remedy to that is to file a breach of the duty of fair representation claim before the EMRB against their union. Concomitant to those claims, they could argue the unfair labor practice claims. In this case specifically, I want to remind the court that the three issues in the complaint are vacation time, a subject of mandatory bargaining, the unilateral alteration of which would theoretically give rise to an unfair labor practice, layoffs, which are subject of mandatory bargaining. They are not arbitrable. There are no due process rights to continued employment on a layoff issue. And the third issue they argue in their complaint is basically also related to the layoffs is bumping, and that has to do with, arguably has to do with procedures. And the reason that this case is sort of awkward to argue and discuss is because we're talking about a complaint that they drafted, and they keep saying breach of contract. They keep saying breach of contract. They refuse to say unfair labor practice. I don't know why. The EMRB is clear in its amicus brief, and I actually think their amicus brief supports our position. They will hear unfair labor practices. So the question this court has to decide is whether or not the complaint here gives rise to any unfair labor practices. If so, that is the exclusive remedy, as this court said in Rosequist, for these individuals. The EMRB keeps saying all you have to do is push. For whatever reason, the appellants here refuse to draft their complaint in the form of an unfair labor practice. They insist on pulling. That's why they we don't know what the EMRB would have done here because they never filed a complaint there. But that's why they're not permitted to go before the district court. And their claim that they should be excused from having to file before the EMRB is not persuasive. The cases they cite For their excuse are Tansy and Crom, I believe, and those cases are factually distinguishable from the one here. Again, these are case-by-case determinations that have to be made based on the four corners of the complaint before the court. Those cases were just cause for termination cases. This is not a just cause for termination case. This isn't property rights, individual rights. This is rights of a collective bargaining unit. These are rights regarding vacation pay of a collective bargaining unit. These are 288 issues.
So in your view, the EMRB could enter an award for each of these employees for unpaid vacation pay and could have, if it found inappropriate or unfair representation, also required relief for bumping. How would that be accomplished? Bumping is a subject of the agreement. How would that unfair labor practice be addressed? I don't see the employee's remedy for that claim.
If and when this...
Because the bumping issue is going to take place by the employer.
Right. I mean, they could arguably name the employer. Now, we're talking hypotheticals because they never went to the EMRB here.
I understand.
But arguably, as we've seen in some of the cases that were cited in our briefing, you can name the public employer as a necessary party, and the remedy could be forcing the case to go to arbitration on those issues. That is a remedy that was actually in their Jackson v. Regional Transit Authority case. That's what they did there, and that was their case.
So the EMRB could compel the union to prosecute the bumping grievance, is your point?
They could compel the arbitration, yes, and they could determine what issues are arbitrable and which are not, as management rights versus unilateral change rights.
So for each of the three alleged grievances in the complaint, there exists a remedy, is your argument?
Absolutely.
And therefore not a necessity to consider the jurisprudence that would allow a direct contract breach under the collective bargaining agreement in
right.
district court.
And not only that, but I think our statutes 288 would, and this court's precedent in Ruiz and in Rosequest, specifically reject such a remedy.
Okay. Any other questions?
I have a question on Rosequest.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit difficult to, it's clear that Rosequest, as between the employee and the union, those are remitted to the EMRB, but as Mr. Levine mentioned, the employer was a defendant in Rosequest, and the district court entered summary judgment on that claim. That claim is almost, the relationship between the employer and the employee is almost not discussed at all in Rosequest. So as I hear you rely on Rosequest, and I don't know the answer to this, I think you may be reading more than it actually holds in terms of saying it favors your client, and I would ask you to comment on that point.
He basically is inferring from the procedure at district court, which was controlled by the decisions of the attorney for the public agency there. They may not have elected to file a motion to dismiss. But subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time in the action, and in that situation, there's no evidence there was a motion to dismiss filed by the employer. So at the end of the day, they did have the claims against them dismissed, absolutely, out of the district court. It just happened to have
but was that part of the litigation in the Supreme Court, those issues between
no.
the employer and the... So that was not decided by us.
Right. The employer in that case, or I'm sorry, the individuals in that case did not appeal the summary judgment award there. However, they did appeal the dismissal, the motion to dismiss against
right.
the union's claims. What I'm saying is this court can use the analysis it used there. Number one, is there a covered entity? 288 covers three entities.
No, I understood that piece of your argument. I'm just not clear that I think you've answered my question. You are extrapolating from the analysis vis-a-vis the employee and the union to the employer, but you're not saying that was actually addressed in Rosequist directly.
Right, but if you substitute out the city, there's no reason that same analysis wouldn't
right.
apply against
I take your
in
point.
Favor of the city here. Also, in that case, again, they looked at the issues of that complaint and how many of them arose under interpretation or application of 288, and that's what this court should look at here. And once it looks at 288.140, 288.110, unilateral alterations on subjects of mandatory bargaining, management rights, those are all issues arising out of 288. There's no question that the parties here are parties named under 288, that this entire thing should go under 288.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for counsel? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Levine?
Yes, let me first start with the failure to exhaust administrative remedies. It is well established that a party is not required to attempt to exhaust administrative remedies if that attempt would be futile. I heard from Ms. Aguayo, we don't know what the EMRB would have done. Yes, we do, because I have brought that case, the exact same case in Tansy, to them. What they would do is they would dismiss the employer, as they did Clark County in Tansy. And I've tried to get Tansy in front of this court on multiple occasions, and we keep having jurisdictional defects. It's going to come back. But if we had filed in front of the EMRB, we would have been dismissed. There is no obligation to pursue an administrative remedy. That would be futile. There is no public policy issue vis-a-vis an absolute management right for layoffs. The allegations of the complaint, which must be taken as true because this was a 12B motion, was that there was an MOU that said that they would not outsource their jobs for 2 years. There is no public policy implicated. What we are saying is you breached that agreement. You owe them 2 years of back pay and benefits in the form of damages because you breached a contract. There's no tremendous burden placed on local government employers by simply honoring contracts. And traditionally, when a contract is violated, if there is no arbitration and grievance procedure, then BACA says you go right to court. If there is an arbitration and grievance procedure, you have to attempt to exhaust that, which we allege we did and were foreclosed by the actions of Teamsters Local 14.
Mr. Levine, did you make the third-party beneficiary argument in the district court?
Yes, because the third-party beneficiary argument arises out of Smith versus Evening News, Vaca versus Sykes, and all of those cases were cited at the district court, and if you review the record, you will see that initially the district court did adopt the Vaca standard and then retreated from it on reconsideration. So it was raised in the district court rule. The right of an employee to bring it was very well briefed, and I would have been happy to proceed under the Vaca standard if the court had denied my motion for reconsideration and the city's.
I don't see any discussion in the district court's orders on this about third-party beneficiary.
The district court didn't have to mention it because third-party beneficiary, of course, is the foundation for the cases such as Smith versus Evening News and all the federal cases up through Vaca. That's why they were allowed. Remember, those cases arose out of the state courts. The employee brought an action in Smith versus Evening News in Michigan, the Michigan state courts. In the Maddox case, it was out of the Alabama state courts. As pointed out in Vaca, the issue as to an employee's ability to pursue a breach of contract action has never been in dispute. And I think that's very important. That's why I led with the quote from Vaca versus Sykes, that Congress, in creating these rights to bargain over grievance and arbitration procedures, did not intend to deprive the individual employee of a remedy. So the question is, where is that remedy? Our position is it's the district court. I know I'm out of time, but I heard Ruiz cited as supporting their position. Obviously, I know a little bit about Ruiz. Ruiz is very distinguishable. What happened in Ruiz was the union took the case to arbitration. There was no allegation of a breach or a failure on the part of the union in that case.
Right. Thank you.
Actually, you know, the amicus brief. She said it supports her position. Does it support your position?
Well,
who does it support?
It supports my position. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at it right here. Its title is amicus brief with the Nevada Local Government Employee Management Relations Board in support of appellants. We're the appellants. They take the position, right in the title, they're supporting our position. They don't have jurisdiction over a contract claim. They don't hear contract claims. The situation that
I think you've answered the justice's question. Thank you.
There's no other questions.
There aren't, and your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. All right. The court appreciates your briefs and arguments here today, and the case will stand submitted.